I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I remember well when the Reserve Bank was just a bond-selling agent of the Treasury.
He would not be willing to reconsider the Greek problem.
A smaller-than-expected increase for consumer prices.
That the United States economy added almost 5 million jobs.
These numbers aren't anyone's opinions or political views.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, she calls it economics, I call it economics, but this week, whatever you call it, are we heading to a world where we only trade with our friends, or at least those who we can tolerate the most? What if China stops dealing with the West, the country which, even with the pandemic, has managed to increase its share of international trade? Over 15% of everything traded on this planet comes from China. So if we stop buying from them, who loses out? That's this week on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So, Steve, what if those BRICS nations, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, really did decide that they're going to form their own alliance and cut back on the trade that they do with Western nations? And also, I mean, because this is part and parcel of it, if they form their own currency in the hope that that will make it easier for them to trade amongst themselves. And I guess also the strength will make it easier if they want to export to the West, then it's going to change the export prices. It's going to make imports presumably more expensive and exports cheaper. So in a way, it's sort of like helping them to develop their trade as well. Who would be, if that was to happen, the combination of more trade amongst themselves, less trade with the West, but also in effect saying we're going to have our own reserve currency, who would be the big winners and losers in that? I have a sneaking suspicion I know the answer.
Well, I'd go for the BRICS themselves over America, yeah. Because the extent to which America has deindustrialized itself over the last 40 years is quite stunning. And there's still a huge amount of manufacturing in America and certainly capacity to innovate. But an enormous part of their capacity has been outsourced to China, and China has run very, very effectively with that. And consequently, if America decides not to import from China anymore, it's got a huge investment task ahead of it to make up for the absence of the commodity that they can't currently produce in the scale they need for their market. Whereas China has got that capacity to produce for itself and can decide now that it doesn't really need the export market anywhere near as much. It can focus upon the domestic market and also other elements of the BRIC chain. So I'd say America's the one that would suffer, not the BRICS.
Yeah, well, they're not getting the stuff that they've been importing. I mean, so in 2021, it was about half a trillion US dollars worth of goods that the US took from China, and only about a third of that went the other way. So a massive trade deficit between the US and China. And it's a real mix of stuff. So obviously, electronic equipment's obviously, we know that's a big thing. And that's, the components that are being used for iPhones and the like. 134 billion of that. 114 billion for machinery, nuclear reactors, boilers, furniture, lighting signs. This is a bit specific. Prefab buildings, 39 billion. Toys and games and sports gear, 37 billion. And then clothing, 34 billion. You can see the lion's share of it is going in that electrical area. So how much of that could the US just say, well, okay, we're just going to move into those areas. We're just going to build our own electronics industry. We'll make the iPhone completely in America rather than relying on cheaper labor elsewhere.
Well, partly the whole hassle about it is how long does it take you to build the plants that enable you to make that transition? And how long does it take you to train the skilled labor that you absolutely vitally need to make those industries feasible in the first place? And that to me is what America has done since it started trying to exploit cheap labor in China, and China exploiting American capitalist desire to exploit cheap labor in China at the same time. That has been going on for pretty much 40 years. And therefore, you had 40 years of low investment by America, not just in the physical machinery, but also in the people who can operate that physical machinery. And if you wanted to really make that change and say, okay, we're going to have American operators of computer controlled cutting machines, lathes, the technicians you need, the metallurgists, et cetera, you're talking 5 years at least to start training the people, and probably 5 to 10 years to build the plants. So while you do that, you're going to have rising costs. And I think this is part of what actually is causing the inflation we're seeing right now, that the globalized supply chain is breaking down, and therefore it's costing more to buy the stuff from overseas anyway. But if you want to replace it domestically, you've got an enormous investment project ahead of you, and the low cost you passed on to consumers to some extent out of exploiting what used to be cheap labor in China is no longer there, so your prices are going to rise. So to me, it's a huge issue of both time and a need to reskill a workforce you've deliberately de-skilled over the last four decades.
Which is, I mean, that's going to take a long time, isn't it? Because you've got to see people coming up through the whole school system before that is eventually realised. So generations we're talking about, really. But what about, you know, even before that, I mean, do you think that we will see this shift? I mean, I mentioned in the introduction that actually China is exporting more than ever as a proportion of all global trade. But do you think we will start to see that wane and BRICS nations will trade amongst themselves?
It's potentially going to happen. I mean, I think we're going to be forced into drastically reducing exports anyway, because there's an enormous amount of energy consumed in shipping these goods from one part of the planet to another. And those costs, forget about what it costs in terms of money to do that, and forget about the comparative labor distances. We simply have to reduce carbon dioxide output, and that's going to be forced upon us at some point, and the whole supply chain will break down because we don't have solar-powered vessels or wind-powered vessels shipping. These are oil-powered. By the way, I'll give you I got a crazy example out of this on Monday of last week when I was in Finland for a workshop organized by Simon Michau, the Australian minerals mining engineer who's now working for the Geological Survey of Finland. And he gave the example of, I've forgotten it, it's canned salmon. And if you go shopping in Scotland, you can buy canned Scottish salmon, or you can buy the fresh stuff down at the local market, but the canned stuff's going to be cheaper. And how's the canned stuff made? Well, it's simple. You catch the salmon off the coast of Scotland, you ship them to China. You then make the steel in China. You put the salmon in the steel in China, and you ship it back to Scotland.
And that's cheaper.
It's cheaper than doing it domestically because of originally with the lower wage costs in China. Now it's, of course, the capital equipment in China is far in advance of what would exist in Scotland. Yeah. But that means that can of tuna has traveled 20,000 miles, whereas the salmon that you actually caught has traveled 20 miles. And the salmon in the can is cheaper.
Yeah, that is good. Now, that's a crazy illustration, isn't it?
And the amount of carbon dioxide generated in the process is enormous. So the carbon dioxide content of the salmon you go and buy at the local market, relatively trivial. The carbon content of the salmon you buy in the can, huge. And so at some point, those decisions are going to have to be made. We have to shut that down. And but at the moment, it's happening through higher energy costs.
Yeah, but yeah, well, okay. So maybe it will become more expensive. And then does that then mean that we do start to, the price mechanism? I know how much you hate that, but the fact it is so prohibitively expensive to do it, perhaps increasingly overseas, that we do start to do it domestically, and we do acquire that expertise.
It will work, but will it work fast enough to stop us consuming? No, because the replacement then means you've got to build the plants in Scotland. If you're going to make your canned stuff, you've got to make it in Scotland. And of course, we're going to decide at some point we don't want cans anymore. We want to have recyclable containers. We don't want people chucking stuff in the garbage bin. That is part of the whole issue of why we're having an ecological crisis in the first place. This linear production rather than to some extent circular. So all these things are going to come aboard and they're all going to make these things more expensive. But certainly in terms of viability, like comparing what happens if you have a breakdown in relation between China and America, and therefore China decides to not forget about the export market, but focus on its own market and building a BRIC alternative. China is in a far better situation to do it because it has a far broader manufacturing base than America does.
But aren't we going through? People call it, talking about all these things being inflationary. You know, it's so much more expensive now because of the supply chains. It's more expensive to get stuff into the country, so that's inflationary. But I mean, this is, and you know, isn't it just a step change? And once that step change has happened, because inflation is, you know, measuring the difference in prices. And if prices go up, then that's inflationary. But it doesn't go on forever because you have, you know, the base effect. The next year thing, unless they're continuing to go up at the same, or escalating, you're going to see inflation start to slow. So we have a step change. Everything costs more. But wages go up to compensate for that. And it all levels off at a new level. So it's then becomes the case that, well, okay, does it really matter whether it's made locally or whether it's made in China? We've got used to the idea that these things cost more, but relative to our salary, it's all evened out. It might take years for that to happen, but it's going to reach a new point. And then that's the point where, the domestic trade can develop.
Are you pitching to take over writing Samuelson's textbook?
tell me what. Tell me who, when.
With very, 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 very dulcet tones about how it's got to be easy and we'll work it out on the long run. I'm not quite so sanguine, I'm afraid. What we'll see is a reversal of the reduction in cost caused by globalization over the last 40 years. And that will then... in some ways, that's actually justified the low increase in wages we've seen ever since the mid-1970s. When you look at that classic chart showing the divergence between productivity and wages beginning in 1974, and so you'd be able to get away with that because prices have also been not rising as rapidly as they would have done without globalization, and therefore the lower wages for workers in the West have been compensated by lower prices of goods which are produced in the third world, and that has meant you've got this 40 years of workers accepting low wage increases because prices aren't as high either, so it sort of evens out. But now when you try to reverse that, you're going to have enormous struggles over the distribution of income in Western societies, which we have put the foot on for the last 40 years. And we're seeing that already because people are saying, oh, there's a wage price spiral. And the workers' response in the UK is, no, there isn't. The prices are way ahead of us. We're not the rising wages are causing prices to rise. We're having wages rising less than prices. And what the movement's called Enough is Enough, that's just started in the UK about two or three weeks ago.
People are saying, well, we're not going to pay our energy bills, is what they're saying.
Can't afford to pay the bills, and our wages are too low. So we've really put the globalization, the whole evolution of the BRICS, which has been driven by Western capitalism trying to exploit low wages in the third world, doing it successfully for 40 years, but therefore, certainly in the case of China, driving up wages over there, so that particular cost advantage has gone. But over that 40-year period, China has radically improved its capacity to manufacture virtually everything, except, as it happens, semiconductors, which are made offshore in Taiwan. But they've got an industrial capacity which America has now lost.
Yeah, the question about Taiwan is an interesting one as well, isn't it? Because if we can pontificate about how this is going to play out, but if those BRICS nations are form a strong alliance against them amongst themselves and against the West, is that the step at which China starts to say, well, Taiwan's really ours, and hey, look, we get chip manufacturing as part and parcel of the bargain?
Well, I mean, that's another wild card I wouldn't like to speculate upon, frankly. I mean, it was weird enough seeing Russia invade Ukraine. Is it this year? I'm getting to lose track.
It's only been going this year.
I don't want to imagine what happens if China tries to invade Taiwan next year. But ironically, the crazy thing about that particular thing, and the most vital thing that Taiwan produces for the global economy happens to be microprocessors. So they've got the market by the balls in terms of production of semiconductors. But there's only, do you realize, this is again one of these crazy factoids about the global economy, the company that produces there's only one company making the technology that makes the chips, and that's actually a Dutch company.
That is just bizarre.
So there's no reason why it hasn't to be Taiwan that produces these. It happens to be Taiwan that then bought these machines. And then it's the location on the global economy in which semiconductors are made, because they've effectively monopolized the buying of there's a couple of other companies that have bought these machines. But I mean, talking incredible machines as well, the level of technology needed to be able to precisely lay down semiconductor routes on silicon substrates at an enormous volume and low cost. It's one company has got the global lead. It's a Dutch company.
I guess it's the ecosystem, though, isn't it, that exists in China? So that, you know, that over the decades they've developed, these hubs. Like, you know, Shenzhen is the hub for the electronics industry. So supply chains work better because companies in that supply chain are close by. And if you were to see, it's not as straightforward as saying, oh, well, let's buy the machine and do it ourselves. You've got to have the whole ecosystem around it. And that could take decades to replicate.
Yeah, you've got to know how to put the whole thing together. I mean, this is one thing I laugh about neoclassicals talking about, how things in called carefully controlled environments won't be affected by climate change. Yes, they're carefully controlled environments. And part of that involves air conditioning, which has been tailored to the current climate. So if you change the climate, you mean the machines don't work anymore, and bang, you can't produce microprocessors. The specialization is both a blessing and a curse. And with the degree of specialization we have in the global economy, we have one company producing 100% of the machines that make microprocessors of that scale, the very, very tiny sub-micron scale. I really don't know the actual scale they operate down to. I lose track after time. But the smallest level circuitry, therefore the highest density of chips, the highest quality coming out, one company makes those machines. One country has monopolized by specialization the ecosystem that makes that thing feasible, and we're all dependent upon it. And that country happens to be one on the border of a big country that wants to invade them. Wow, that's what I call a sustainable situation.
But at least the machines are made by someone. You know, it becomes an us and them approach that we see for the rest of this century. At least that machine is made by someone on our side, unless it becomes the BRICS nations, and we have Brazil, Russia, India, the Netherlands, and China. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But look, there's lots more to explore. I want to look more at this idea of a reserve currency, but also, you know, have we just been buying bad stuff from China? Is that relationship bad for the environment? We've still got that to come on the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We are this week looking at the BRICS nations. Will they go it alone, or will we trade with them less? And is that necessarily a bad thing? Well, in the short term, it might be. But look, in the long term, Steve, I mean, it is not a great relationship, is it, in terms of as far as the planet is concerned? So we talked about renewables before and about, you know, delivering fish in cans and how crazy that was, that it was transported all around the world. And of course, you know, even just the idea of a can itself rather than some sort of renewable material. But I mean, the labor cost advantage is whittling away in China, isn't it? But companies have gone there because there's very little compliance. So that's an advantage for business. They could do things there that wouldn't be possible in the West, like paying injury compensation or insurance, for example. You know, ethically, it's not very good. But also, it's lousy for the planet. So, you know, if we are looking at global supply chains, just how much extra carbon is that pushing into the atmosphere? And would we be better bringing more stuff home so that we can control the behavior and ensure that we are developing an ecosystem that is better for the planet?
Yeah, a large part of the low cost we've got out of this whole process in the last 40 years has been completely ignoring those vital issues for the long-term sustainability of capitalism. And that's the scary thing. Capitalism without constraints will end up destroying itself. And this is the danger that we now face. But in that situation, once it starts to happen, which country is a better place to be able to maintain their own productive capacities? And I know a whole lot of the hassle with China, but in terms of being able to produce what you need domestically, China is well ahead of the United States. And so if we look at these trade wars coming out, the attempt to build an alternative currency system for international trade to the US dollar, but also domestic self-sufficiency, America's main advantage there is its sheer scale and how long it's been of that scale. It's still, you talked about the level of imports that it has. The level of imports compared to GDP in America is still, I think, one of the lowest in the world because it has been such a self-sufficient for so long. But they've outsourced a lot of that over the last 40 years, and now they'll pay the price for it if they try to bring it back on shore.
Well, China, it looks like, you know, what they're getting from the US. I mean, they're getting electric equipment back as well. Probably the stuff that they've made, just stuck in a nice box with a manual added. $22 billion dollars worth of that. Mineral fuels, oils, distillation products, stuff like that. Machinery, they're sending some of that their way. And then $18 billion in some foodstuffs, oil seed, fruits, grains, seeds, fruits. I said fruits twice there. They must take it. They eat well. You know, China, if you had BRICS nations working together, I mean, there's plenty of that, isn't there? You know, I mean, Russia invaded Ukraine. They've got all the agricultural land. You know, perhaps they had that in view for this new world order that they're planning amongst themselves. I'm being very paranoid here. But you hear some of the stuff that Putin's been saying, talking to these other leaders, and you can't help feeling there's something going on.
Well, there are elements of that. I mean, I never deny the existence of conspiracies. What I deny is whether the conspirators know what the hell they're doing. The outcomes are always rather different to what they expect. And I think that the classic for Putin is it's taken a bit more than 3 days to conquer Ukraine. So, those things can go wrong. But, you know, what's driving a lot of this is that, I think America's financial system is the part of America that's benefited out of dominating the global financial exchange system by having the US dollar as the international currency.
Yeah. And they're finally pissed off about it.
But also because they try to make the payment system as a weapon. So I've forgotten when it actually began, but with SWIFT, they tried to block Russia out of SWIFT and China out of SWIFT at one point, meaning that you could, if because they control the financial system and SWIFT being the telecommunications units used for international banking, then if you get blocked off SWIFT, you can't trade anymore. And that, I think, was a huge tactical mistake to do that, because that has then inspired the BRIC countries to say, well, we need to have our own alternative payment system. And like one of the cleverest things that Putin did in terms of the invasion of Ukraine was to say, if you want to buy Russian oil, you've got to pay in rubles. And suddenly you've broken down that control that Americans could have had over the purchasing of goods from Russia in the vital good of energy. So there are a lot of ways in which I think America stymied itself by the short-term focus on profitability, meaning that's why they went for globalization back in the 80s and 90s. And now they're paying for it, both in terms of diminished domestic production capacity, a far less educated workforce, and then now inspiring the BRIC countries to bring about their own international payment system. So that source of potential blackmail is removed.
Yeah, and Putin is the one who's championing that, obviously. And you can imagine that, you've got a right-wing crazed lunatic in Brazil right now. China, we know, Xi and Putin have been talking, and you know, India, I guess, also looking at what its place is in this new world. So I mean, it could easily come off, couldn't it, this idea of their own reserve currency. He's saying, Putin says, you know, backed by precious metals. Do they need to do that? I'm not really quite sure. And then, yes, the other thing is, as you say, their own mechanism for international payments. I mean, they basically want to cut themselves out of their reliance on the Western financial system, don't they? That's what they're doing.
And that's the only part of America that benefited from America being the reserve currency. Again, if you go back to Bretton Woods, Keynes's idea was to have a internationally created currency called the Bancor. And the Bancor would be issued by what became the International Monetary Fund. And it would be issued in proportion to the scale of the economy. So America would have got the lion's share of Bancor. England would have been number two back in those days, et cetera, et cetera. And then you would have fixed exchange rates. And if you ran a balance of trade deficit, you would run out of Bancor, so you'd be forced to devalue. But equally, if you ran a balance of trade surplus, there'd be interest charges put on that, which would be used to provide fund for developing economies. And that vision was to mean that there was no country dominating the international payment system. And it would have worked far better than what we got. Because one of the dangers, and Yanis Varoufakis writes very well about this in the Global Minotaur, one of the dangers of being the reserve currency is that the other countries have a demand for your currency over and above their desire to buy your goods. So you want American dollars, just like you use British pounds more for trade than for buying British goods. You also wanted American dollars more for trade than buying American goods. And you get an overvalued currency, which means your manufacturing sector and your other parts which you're trying to export are less competitive with the rest of the world. So you end up with a trade deficit. And that's the situation America has been in. So I would prefer to see a currency based on at least on a basket of countries rather than a single currency. That reduces the odds for it happening. It's a bit more like Keynes's original proposal. So I'm actually in favor of the BRICS having their own alternative payment system, because we should never have had the American dollar as the reserve currency in the first place.
So what was, in the short term, if they did that, what impact would that have? Would it weaken the US dollar? And you know, quite markedly, I would imagine. And what would that do to America and the world price for goods and energy and the like?
Well, it would mean American currency falls in value. It would actually give a competitive advantage to America for exports, which it needs, because, you know, again, part of this debilitated manufacturing sector. And part of the reason why they should buy the Chinese goods more easily when they outsource production to China is they were buying with overinflated American dollars. The American pieces of paper were worth too much. So it would actually force them back into having a focus on developing the manufacturing sector again, which would be a bit of a change from developing the Rust Belt instead. So, but in the short term, yes, you know, falling American dollar value, therefore higher price of the goods they're importing that they used to manufacture domestically.
So, and there's a bit of strength in those BRICS nations. They account for 26% of the world's oil output, 50% of iron ore production, which obviously is used to make steel, which is important for China. They produce about 40% of global corn production, 46% of global wheat production. So, I mean, they've got, you know, they're dominating a lot of those markets. I guess, you know, you could say, well, okay, the rest of the world actually, if it's less than 50%, the rest of the world still has more of those things. But of course, you know, it's a much smaller. Well, actually, no, this is a large part of the population, of course, isn't it, of the world. They are still going to need to trade with us.
Yeah, but certainly China has been incredibly successful in industrializing using this process. I've seen the contrast because I happen to be ages ago, like 1980, the late 1970s, early 1980s, I was working in overseas aid, and I got into my head the idea of running seminars between journalists from third world countries and Western countries, where they'd compare the coverage of each country in the other's press as part of a way of you know, breaking down the extent to which we think about other countries ideologically rather than based on their real historical circumstances. So I took a group of Australian journalists to China for a seminar where they reviewed 1 year of Chinese coverage of Australia and 1 year of Australian coverage of China on a range of different areas. It was quite a fantastic seminar, if I must say so myself. But after we went on a tour of China at that time, and we saw the state of Chinese factories. Now, we actually saw a Chinese factory when light bulbs were made by hand. You know, the hand blowing and placing the fiber inside the incandescent light bulb, et cetera, et cetera. Incredibly primitive technology. And the whole idea of, from China's point of view, of the industrialization process and the opening up of free trade zones that they did, was to get American technology as fast as possible. And they succeeded. And now, when you look at the level of Chinese technology in a vast number of industries, it's equal to or superior to American technology. So that focus on getting the technology and in developing the economy has worked massively. And when you go and spend time, I've been in Sichuan in 1981, I think it was, December 1981. And I've been back 30 years later and 35 years later and seen the standard of living. And it is astronomically better. So the Chinese public, whatever people might say about the, you know, dominated by the Communist Party and, you know, Big Brother is watching you type stuff. And the physical standards of the Chinese people has risen dramatically. And that's a major reason why they end up supporting Xi, despite the fact that he seemed like a throwback to Mao in many ways. So China's done very well out of this, better than any other country in the so-called list of the BRICS. And when it comes to what's sustainable for the future, if there's a conflict, then China is far more sustainable as an economy now in terms of its capacity to produce what it needs domestically than it was 30 or 40 years ago.
So here's the
interesting... America is less so.
Yeah, that applies, you know, to a lot of other countries as well. If we had the BRICS nations versus the rest of the world, a lot of the rest of the world are capitalist nations that aren't doing so well. These BRICS nations are, by and large, centralized economies. So what does that do to the pattern of global trading? You know, if we can't pursue can we pursue capitalism if we're trading with others that are not, you know, if they are subsidizing or they are buying up, like, for example, the, you know, farmland being bought up overseas by companies that are basically funded by the Chinese government, which is, you know, money that the Chinese government has created. I mean, it distorts the whole market, doesn't it? I mean, it has, obviously, historically, but going forwards, if we've got these, you know, two sides of the world competing against each other, and one of them is very centralized in its approach, I mean, they've got a bit of an unfair advantage. It sounds a bit of a crazy thing to say. They've got an unfair advantage because they're not relying on capitalism, which doesn't sound right, perhaps.
Well, according to theory, they should be doing worse, you know.
Yes.
The reality is that it meant much more effective public investment and transportation, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. Where you got the degradation of the same facilities in America. So it's a... you know, the textbook hasn't given you the answer. It didn't predict the future all that accurately. America has stymied itself very, very badly by outsourcing its productive capability. And whereas the Chinese in particular, I'm not so sure about India or Brazil or certainly for that matter, Russia, but the China's success in industrializing has come at the expense of American capitalism.
So listen, we've got some new listeners to the podcast now. It's available free every week, and those people will learn very quickly that I tend to have a more optimistic view of the future than Steve does, but then you might also come to the conclusion that my views are largely unrealistic and Steve's perhaps are more on the money. But I look at all of this and I think, well, you know, the reasons why we've got this divide happening, you know, as we said before, it's those nations are concerned about the dominance of the Western financial system and they want to develop their own system so they can go it alone. We've got the concern that we want to move forward in a more sustainable way. And we might be worried about the way that they are going to move forward because they're going to have less focus on sustainability and more on growth, particularly when you've got large countries with poor populations that they want to see moving up to the middle class. We don't have that issue to contend with. I just wonder whether there's a middle ground where we actually say, well, yes, actually, we think a great idea that we have a reserve currency, which is, you know, let's go back to what Maynard Keynes was saying all those years ago. Let's do that. Let's implement that. But let's also, you know, as on a global scale, look at the planet as well and try and find a model that's going to work for all of us. I mean, if it would be a big move, wouldn't it, to say, yes, let's move that reserve currency out of the United States and just have a global reserve currency. You don't need to do it for yourselves because we're all going to be on board with that.
Well, I think that particular argument shows that the real beneficiary of the America being the reserve currency has been its financial sector, not its manufacturing. manufacturing sector.
Yeah.
And that is one reason why Americans find themselves complaining about, you know, infrastructure breaking down and not having the skilled workforce they need for the future. There's no way, the American financial capital is so dominant in the overall American political scene that there's no way they would ever abandon having the American dollar as the reserve currency, even though I think it would be better for America as a whole to get rid of it. So you do need somebody coming in from the outside and say, well, we're going to produce our own system and try to sideline you. And then that might actually force the Americans to the bargaining table over whether we have an international system dominated by the dollar or by a basket of currencies and get away from the bizarre balance of trade and balance of payments gaps we have today.
Yeah. So BRICS, bring it on then. Basically, is what you're saying. Yeah, just trying to avoid all the bit where you invade sovereign territories. That would be good.
That'd be a good change. Yeah,
you'd avoid that a bit, but yeah, on the rest of it, the idea that you build your own mechanism for international payments, your own reserve currency, go for your life. You reckon?
Yeah, I want to see it happen.
Yeah, well, I'm sure America doesn't, but sounds like they're not going to have much choice. Good to talk, Steve. We'll catch you again next week.
Okay, bye.
And thank you for listening. That's this week's edition of the Debunking Economics Podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. You can catch us all every week at debunkingeconomics.com or on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about us. Now we are free and available for everyone. We'll catch you again next week. Thanks for listening.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.